So thanks also to the organizers for giving me a chance to come to this workshop. So as Rajiv announced, can you all see this? This is pretty good. I'll talk about recent work that we've done that involved crystal growth, neutron scattering in Monte Carlo of the diluted spin 1/2 square lattice Heisenberg antiferromagnet. And really much of the credit goes to Owen Weick and Patrick Meng, the two students primarily involved in this project. And we also had some help from Takao Zasegawa, who is actually at Tokyo University. He's visiting for 1 year. He helped us in characterizing some of our samples. It's a brief outline. I'll first summarize some structural and magnetic properties of lanthanum copper oxide, the spin 1/2 parent compound for our experimental studies, and to which we have diluted magnetic magnesium and zinc. And then I will review briefly some earlier neutron results for the system rubidium manganese fluoride diluted with magnesium, a diluted spin 1/2 system, which shows classical behavior. And then also summarize some more recent SCRT measurements on this particular system that we are interested in. Classical as in large spin. It shows basic behavior consistent with the classical percolation picture. And I will briefly discuss the growth and characterization of the crystals that we grew. We succeeded for the first time in growing large single crystals over a rather wide range of dilution of the system, which really enabled us to do these experiments. And then the core really of my talk will be, and can you actually see, I'm standing in front of the talk, is the neutron measurements of the static structure factor, which we carried out at NIST in Maryland, which allowed us to obtain the spin correlation, the instantaneous spin-spin correlation. And then towards the end, I will compare with our numerics for the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model, randomly diluted on the square lattice, and show that the two neutron and Monte Carlo agree very nicely. So, briefly about the crystal structure. The structure of these lamellar copper oxides can be rather complicated, but they have all one thing in common, that's the copper oxygen sheet, where I've labeled or shown the coppers in red, the oxygens in blue, the in-plane oxygens in blue. And so the at high temperatures, lanthanum copper oxide is tetragonal. The body center is tetragonal structure, and each copper is surrounded by four in-plane and two out-of-plane apical oxygens. At low temperatures, the structure distorts below 530 Kelvin in a staggered fashion, the octahedral tilt. And that is something that makes the full spin Hamiltonian a little bit more complicated than the ideal system. I'll go into that in a moment. There's a second material, I'll go briefly over that. Strontium copper chloride, quite analogous to lanthanum copper oxide, but it does not distort at low temperatures, so in some sense it's a more ideal square lattice system. But this material cannot be doped, so we work with lanthanum copper oxide, which for all practical purposes actually is just as good. And all these systems are not ideal in the sense that they are to first order described by the Heisenberg spin Hamiltonian, but then there are correction terms in the full Hamiltonian, anisotropies and 3D couplings are relevant at low enough temperatures. So just briefly, lanthanum copper oxide has basically a trivalent lanthanum filled xenon shell, and then oxygen exists in form of oxygen 2- with a filled 2p orbital, so that for overall charge neutrality, one has copper holes basically in an almost filled 3D shell, And because of crystalline field effects, one has actually a splitting of the fivefold degenerate d orbitals into a hierarchy in which the holes exist in dx squared minus y squared orbitals. So experimentally, one observes that these holes are localized and that the there's a rather large antiferromagnetic superexchange interaction of the order of 1500 Kelvin. And as I just mentioned, the system, the spin Hamiltonian, full spin Hamiltonian, has additional terms. Next nearest neighbor term, which is somewhere of the order of 5 to 10%, so one can deduce that value roughly from squid magnetization, also from neutron measurements of related cuprate. Then there are, if one considers spin orbit interactions, an antisymmetric exchange term and a XY anisotropy term, the former, which is about two orders of magnitude smaller than J, exists only in the orthorhombic phase of lanthanum copper oxide, and it essentially has an amplitude that is proportional to the tilt amplitude, the octahedral tilts. And then there's a non-zero, of course, a non-zero 3D coupling, which in lanthanum copper oxide in the orthorhombic phase is not frustrated, of the order of 10 to the minus 5. In the high temperature phase, this coupling is frustrated, a coupling between neighboring sheets. So combination of all these terms leads to a non-zero nail temperature, strictly for a 2D system, the continuous order parameter only. Only a zero temperature ordered state could be allowed, but here one observes nail temperatures in this material slightly above room temperature, and the other system, strontium copper from chloride, slightly below room temperature. Okay, so the Heisenberg model is extremely difficult to deal with directly, and it's been a long-standing problem until the late 80s when Chakrabarty, Halperin, and Nelson, I think largely probably motivated by the early neutron work on lanthanum copper oxide, studied the quantum nonlinear sigma model, which is the simplest effective low energy, long wavelength theory to capture the low temperature properties of the Heisenberg model, and map basically the Heisenberg model onto the nonlinear sigma model, and then As a function of the two model parameters, the spin and the spin wave velocity, we're able to do a renormalized synchronization group analysis, and came up with a phase diagram which has three phases: a classical renormalized phase, a phase controlled by a quantum critical point, and then a disordered phase. They argued that the system lanthanum copper oxide, or the Heisenberg model on the square lattice with nearest neighbor interactions. And spin 1/2 corresponds to the first phase, the one with the renormalized classical ground state. We're able to do a two-loop renormalization group analysis of that model in that regime, and arrived at the expression for the instantaneous spin-spin correlation length, which has an inverse temperature, exponential inverse dependence, and a temperature-independent prefactor. To first the loop order, this would still depend on temperature. And this was eventually, you know, it was found that results, experimental results, were pretty much in good agreement with this theoretical form. And since then, through a number of refinements, both on the theory side and the experimental side, we have a very good quantitative picture of not only the model, but also of the experimental system, the undiluted system. And so on the theory side, Hasenfratz and Niedermeyer extended essentially Chakrabarty, Halperin, Nelson's work, and were able to find the exact exponential prefactor and first-order temperature correction. This is a three-loop result. And since the spin stiffness and spin wave velocity are known very well in terms of the microscopic parameters, lattice constant and J, the superexchange, one arrives basically at an expression that one can then directly compare with the experiment. Expression for the instantaneous spin-spin correlation length. So I want to just go through that for the undiluted system. as a base for the discussion of what we found in the diluted spindle half system. So this is a figure I took from Alexei Svilik's textbook, which does compare the experiment that that we did on the system strontium copper chloride, shown by the open symbols. This is a semi-log plot of the correlation length in reduced units versus inverse temperature, again in reduced units. J is known to be about 125 millielectron volts in this system. And so the experimental data with some representative error bars, this is about room temperature, and this is 1500 Kelvin, or J. And with black circles are Monte Carlo data by Markiewicz and Ding from the early 90s. And there's no adjustable parameters in this comparison, and the two experiment and numerics agree very nicely. And the two combined with compared with theory also compare very nicely. There are some systematic deviations of, in particular, the numerics, the theory, say, from the numerics, and those deviations are real. The theory is really strictly only the low-temperature theory, and so we know now that actually strictly in the asymptotic regime of that theory really only sets in at about J upon T of 5, where the correlations are a few hundred thousand lattice constants. But it does remarkably well for spin 1/2 in the experimentally accessible temperature regime, which is actually not the case for higher spin. So then slightly more recent data for lanthanum copper oxide on the same curve, again, the reduced correlation length in units of the lattice constant versus inverse temperature in units of J, J being somewhat larger than in strontium copper chloride. This is the data for lanthanum copper oxide, and as you see, they agree just as well with numerics, with the other experimental system, of course, or with the low temperature theory in this intermediate temperature regime. And note that J upon 3, roughly, is the temperature at which the system undergoes a structural transition. So below this temperature, it's orthorhombic. Above it, it is tetragonal. But there's really no indication from these correlation length data that the structural transition really has an impact on the spin-spin correlations in this paramagnetic regime. And J upon 5, roughly, is room temperature. That's the temperature roughly at which lanthanum copper oxide orders. So all these data are in the paramagnetic regime.
What is the physical meaning of the points where A is much smaller than 1?
Oh, this is numerics. And there's really no deep physical meaning to that. But if you, you know, Markiewicz and Ding did this work, and you can, if you have a real space correlation function, you fit it to an exponential form, you extract a length, and that length may be smaller than 1. There's no deep physical meaning to it.
In the high energy side, where the model is concerned.
Pardon me?
This is Monte Carlo.
The circles are quantum Monte Carlo for the nearest neighbor model, and the it's basically this three loop expression really strictly is only valid for lengths that are above 100,000 lattice constants. It does surprisingly well even in this temperature regime.
Reduce.
Oh, reduce is just unit. This is length divided by length, and this is energy divided by energy, or temperature divided by temperature.
What inversion I find is this agreement was accidental.
I don't think it's entirely accidental in the sense that at high temperatures you get some. You get classical behavior, right? And somehow the low temperature behavior has to map onto the high temperature behavior. And it just so turns out that, and maybe I should go to the next view graph, I can explain that better, in the framework at least of the quantum nonlinear sigma model. This is the phase diagram as derived by Chakravarti, Haltman, Elson. The spin 1/2 system lies here at the coupling constant, which still is small enough to give an ordered ground state. And so the regime for which this theoretical expression exists is this renormalized classical regime. At high temperatures, you have classical behavior. And then you have some crossover regime. And turns out that spin 1 would lie here, spin 5 half would be down here, that this renormalized classical regime in temperature units that again reduced in units of the spin stiffness actually becomes smaller and smaller at lower coupling constants. So for spin 1/2, one has a relatively extended regime, which then not quite, but almost directly goes into the classical regime. Whereas for the larger spin systems, one has sort of an intermediate regime. In other words, the Riemann-Weiss classical form breaks down at a lower temperature. And so they're experimentally and also numerically, one sees deviations that are much stronger. So yes, one I guess you could call it coincidental. These deviations are of the order of 10 to 20% actually, if you look carefully. If you compare the asymptotic form over an extended regime with numerics, the deviations are of order 20%. They're of the order of 100% in the same temperature regime for, say, the spin 1 model.
Where's spin 3/2?
Spin 3/2 is down here, down by a factor of 3. So basically in this model, the control parameter goes like the spin wave velocity divided by the spin stiffness goes like spin divided by spin squared. So it goes like 1 over spin. So spin 3/2 would be a factor of 3 down here. And this curve is just a sketch that I took over from Chakravarti, Halp, and Nelson's field, but this phase boundary really is not well known. And it should, if anything, should actually come down like this. So what I wanted to get at on this view graph is that there is this quantum critical point which controls over a certain temperature regime the physics, and which for which basically as a prediction as to what the temperature dependence of the spin-spin correlation length ought to be, and since temperature in this regime is the only relevant energy scale, it just goes like inverse temperature. In the quantum disordered regime, there's a gap, and correspondingly the low temperature correlation length remains finite. But we know that this spin 1/2 system, the unalluded system, lies on the Riemann-Weiss classical side. And now a question that you may ask is what happens when you put in dilutants into the square lattice? One may naively want to think of this as a reduction of the effective spin of the system or a reduction of the spin stiffness, primarily at least, and of the system moving towards this quantum critical point. At least that's the question that has been posed by some. So the question is the story for spin 1/2, the diluted system, the same as for the spin 5/2 system, where one has classical behavior, that is, where one reaches the classical percolation thresholds where basically the zero temperature critical point is a geometric critical point, or is the story more complicated, having a spin 1/2 quantum mechanical system, and is it possible to have a quantum critical point basically before actually reaching 41% dilution, which is the classical side percolation threshold? It's basically these questions that motivated us to try to grow crystals at first and see actually if we could do this at all. Because there were only single crystals, people had only succeeded to grow single crystals up to 7 or 8% dilution. So just briefly, what one has sort of classically is at low dilution, just some missing sites on the square lattice, but still everything is connected very nicely. And then at higher dilution, one still has an infinite connected cluster, but with some islands of spins here and there. And then when one goes beyond the percolation threshold of about slightly less than 41% dilution, one only has disconnected clusters of various sizes. And then lowering basic temperature in terms of behavior of the spin-spin correlation length, it saturates basically at a value that corresponds to the larger clusters in the percolating system. And in the highly diluted system. So this is a summary of the results alluded to earlier of the spin 5/2 system diluted with magnesium. This was done in the 70s by neutron scattering, and what showing you is the inverse correlation length versus temperature. And you see that if these two systems are at high dilution, so this notation is actually different from what I just used. C is the concentration of the magnetic ions now. So for C smaller than 60% or 59%, correlations, the inverse correlations are finite, as the correlation length does not diverge. And this line through the data is a fit to a is essentially a description which puts the geometrical length and the thermal length on equal footing, and it has a power law which has an exponent of the order of 1, which is expected based on classical percolation theory. And then at larger concentrations of magnetic ions, the correlations diverge basically at a non-zero temperature. The system enters a 3D Néel state. And so one other figure I wanted to show you is a figure of, again, the inverse correlation length versus concentration, again, of magnetic ions. So as you approach the geometrical critical point, basically this is the extracted low temperature correlation length. The correlation length diverges, so copper goes to zero, and it goes to zero as predicted essentially classically. So here's the summary of this susceptibility data for diluted spin 1/2. This first figure is taken from Chong et al.'s paper, which actually summarizes not just their results, but also what's been seen prior, what's been studied prior to their study. The dashed line is the classical result. This is dilution, and this is the Néel temperature divided by the Néel temperature of the undiluted system. So Néel temperature is suppressed gradually and essentially disappears at the classical threshold of 41% dilution. An early study in the late 80s by Chakraborty et al. Found that diluting lanthanum copper oxide with zinc suppressed the Néel temperature much, much more dramatically than the classical result. But then turned out that they had not worried about possible excess oxygen in their material. And we know that excess oxygen donates holes in the copper oxygen sheets, it frustrates the sheets and suppresses the Néel temperature very dramatically. So then Chong et al. Went ahead and these are both powder studies, and had their own series of measurements in which they found that there's a more gradual fall off of the Néel temperature, but still more dramatic than expected classically. And their curve, the data stopped at about 20% dilution, and it would extrapolate to zero Néel temperature about 23 or so percent. Well below, again, the classical threshold. And then earlier this year, study by Hooker et al., again on powders, went further out to 25% dilution, and they find an essential linear drop of the Néel temperature versus dilution. This line extrapolates to zero now at 33% roughly. And you see here the Néel temperature for the undiluted system is about 280-290 Kelvin. We know that properly reduced lanthanum copper oxide, so again, this is zinc-doped lanthanum copper oxide. The study by Chong et al. was both zinc-doped and magnesium-doped. And they were able to put in more magnesium than zinc, so these circles here pertain to the magnesium-doped system, actually. This study by Hooker et al. Is one on zinc-doped lanthanum strontium copper oxide, actually, but they have some data on just the system without strontium. And the for the undiluted system is low effect actually for a properly reduced system. So there's some question as to whether they fully reduced all their samples as well. So you can imagine that properly reduced set of systems of crystals would actually have a line shifted possibly, and then things may be more and more consistent with actually the classical picture. So these are all powder studies, and yes.
Was there also a ferromagnet in the upper panel?
Yes, there was also a ferromagnet in the upper panel.
Compared?
That's those crosses here, and essentially the Néel temperature goes to zero at around the classical threshold. But the Curie temperature. This is a spin 1/2 diluted spin 1/2 system, but it's a ferromagnet.
Okay, so it drops to zero.
Yes. Yes.
Did they do all the separate data on the same materials?
Yes, that's how these, how at least Chakraborty and Chong et al. Extracted these nail temperatures. They extracted those data from squid magnetization measurements. Does that answer your question? Yes. That's 33%. But they went up to 20. So here they have a nail temperature of 50 Kelvin at 25%. That's as far as they went out. I believe that there's no issue regarding the ferromagnet, but there the role of quantum fluctuations is quite different, as you know. So I actually am not familiar with additional studies besides the one that is indirectly shown here.
Theoretically, there is no reason why a ferromagnet would not persist up to the geometrical circulation threshold. Is the antiferromagnet, the excitations may destroy the antiferromagnet.
Yes.
Is it lanthanum 2 minus set or lanthanum?
This is a study quite generally of lanthanum, strontium, copper, zinc oxide, in which they have some set of data with zero strontium, but non-zero zinc. So this is x equals zero. This panel here is which I took out of it.
The z of zinc corresponds to the x of strontium.
No, the z of zinc corresponds. So this is lanthanum 2 minus x, strontium x at x equals zero, and then copper 1 minus z, zinc z, O4 plus delta. So this is at x equals zero, but z larger than zero, but probably not at delta exactly zero. At least the data here at the zero dilution indicate that they didn't force out. And the heat treatment that they employed is from what we've learned, is not enough. They reduced their samples at 600 centigrade in a reducing atmosphere, I think nitrogen or argon, but that doesn't quite actually drive out all the oxygen. Okay, so then, since we have mentioned this already, there are then a number of open questions. First of all, the overriding open question is basically to us is the story for the diluted quantum system, diluted spin 1/2 different system, different from what's been seen in say the spin 5/2 system. There are some very recent theoretical studies which arrive at the conclusion that there is a quantum critical point at around 30 and 30.5% dilution. This is a modified spin wave theory study diagonal cross check and combines the classical percolation theory with the quantum nonlinear sigma model. I believe Antonio gave a talk here during the conference. And so, of course, then, as I explained, there's all these inconsistent results for the nail temperature versus dilution. So that is a sub-question, basically, that we wanted to address. And we initially started, as I said, by just trying to grow crystals and see how far we could go. There was no quantum Monte Carlo, to my knowledge, really, in the regime where the correlations are larger than a few lattice constants. And for the, at least the quantum problem, there's no theory. So these are the crystal growth furnaces that we used. These are really state-of-the-art optical furnaces that focus light from halogen lamps onto a cylindrical feed rod, and basically melt the tip of the feed rod that is then put in contact with the seed crystal. And then the whole mirror stage, the light is focused by mirrors onto the feed rod. It's the whole mirror stage is slowly moved upwards, and one hopes to grow a crystal in that process. And this technique is free of the problems that go along with the crucible bound techniques. That is, one does not get any impurities from a crucible. This is a free-hanging setup. So traditionally, what's been used to grow these systems is platinum crucibles to contain the melt. And you get platinum impurities, which like to go onto the copper side, which really is bad, especially when it's detrimental to the superconductivity in the related superconductors. But here, it's also something that you really don't want. So these are some crystals that the students have grown. Typically, you get, when things go well, something that's 4 to 5 millimeters in diameter and about 10 centimeters long. The first 3 to 5 centimeters are not single grain, typically. So one ends up with a single grain piece of the order of 2 inches in length and 4 millimeters to 5 millimeters in diameter. And that is really also the volume that one needs in order to be able to do reasonably good neutron measurements. From neutron diffraction, we found sort of in our test that we get mosaics better than 10 minutes of arc. So these crystals are actually of very good quality. Now, first, let me show you some squid magnetization data taken on slices of these crystals. And the nail temperature of the undiluted system, so these are data taken with a field of 1 tesla perpendicular to the copper oxygen sheets. And the susceptibility is in arbitrary units. These three sets of data are shifted just for clarity. And so the nail temperature of the undiluted system is at around 325-320 Kelvin. You have a cusp in the susceptibility, which essentially is a result of the fact that you have this Jawlensky-Moria antisymmetric term in the spin Hamiltonian, which leads to a small canting of the spins of the copper oxygen sheets, and the canting alternates from layer to layer, and so you have a strong effect basically as you enter the nail state. And so this can be used as a pretty accurate determination of the nail temperature, the nail temperature that we've extracted from squid measurements, and later on from neutron diffraction of the Bragg reflections are in very good agreement with each other. So the nail temperature of these are all reduced crystals. Of the 7% diluted crystal is about 220 Kelvin. Then at 19% dilution, it's about 90 Kelvin. The amplitude also is a function, of course, of the volume of the crystal that is used. And then at 29%, we find a nail temperature of about 30 Kelvin. And you see, I mean, there's a Curie tail that these features ride on, and that Curie tail is a result of the dilution itself, in the sense that each non-magnetic dilutant carries with it essentially a ferromagnetic moment, basically due to the mismatch from the two sublattices, and so essentially you get a Curie contribution, which to first orders is really proportional to the number of non-magnetic dilutants that you put into the system.
Curie temperature, as you discussed before, depends on all the other things which are left out of the Heisenberg model.
The nail temperature, yes.
The nail temperature, really, yeah. And would those things be independent of the dilution?
No, I don't think they are fully independent. In fact, I'll get to that in a moment. Probably already the next few graphs. We found that dilution of the system introduces a new structural phase at low temperatures in the medium and high dilution regime. And so the system becomes tetragonal again, tetragonal but with a lower symmetry than at high temperatures. And so I'm sure that the spin Hamiltonian is changed as a result of simply being a different structure, but that's something to be explored. Certainly the Hamiltonian does not strictly stay the same. The lattice constants also change somewhat.
Now, strictly speaking, if you have only nearest neighbors, then the loose spin, the ones that give you the Curie thing, should depend on the number of missing A's minus the number of missing B's. Okay. If they're missing equal numbers, then
local, this is a local effect.
What are missing A's and missing B's? Well, you have penetrating the NDs.
So locally, if there's on one sublattice one missing spin,
yes.
Then you get a spin one half moment.
Somewhere
then you send, no, you still get from each dilutant, you get a Curie contribution, but these moments can actually start to interact with each other.
He wants to put loose moments on the dilutants, right? Not around.
But loose moments come from the dilution. When you take away the magnetic atom, you're not actually introducing this thing. If you do an equal numbers on these, they cancel. So
they cancel globally. No, they cancel globally, but this is a local effect, right? If
it's only for the single is a very low energy for the coupling is really weak.
Oh, so maybe it comes like that.
So the coupling is mediated by the antiferromagnetism between the dilutants, essentially. And that coupling basically has it is very weak and it falls off exponentially, actually with the antiferromagnetic correlation length as the characteristic length. So the coupling becomes weaker at larger distances, exponentially weak.
Isn't the correlation distance becoming bigger and bigger?
Yes, but I believe that the coupling between these ferromagnetic moments falls off like e to the r over psi.
Is the amplitude of the Curie term linear in the concentration?
Say that again, please.
The amplitude of the Curie term grows with the concentration of the dilution.
To first is this linear? Yes, to first order it is linear.
And it's a one over t.
To first order these degrees of freedom are decoupled.
What Dan says it should be called the square root of the concentration.
That's whatever it is. I mean, even for the correlation length, this interaction would drop off of the power.
Yeah. But that's good to prevent the
Curie.
Yeah. That's basically low, huh?
I mean, I have to admit, this is not an aspect of the data that we fully explored quantitatively at this stage. But I mean, to the extent that I mean, I believe that it is actually linear. But we have done numerics as well, and for the numerics, I think the statement also pertains that it's the first order linear actually. But again, this is something we haven't. I mean, our primary reason for taking these sort of preliminary squid data was actually to just establish the nail temperature and to see if there was a shift after reduction or not. We can talk about that a little bit later. But at extremely low temperatures, this, right? Yeah.
Related question. That we know that you can dilute this plate with zinc or with nickel, and they have entirely different magnetic properties, the dilutants themselves.
Yes.
Do you see that in your copy? Can you try that with
nickel? We have not yet tried nickel. We have tried only the non-magnetic dilutants, but it should be very interesting to pursue that as well.
Because zinc becomes more magnetic than nickel.
Well, I think you have a similar situation if you put in a spin 1 for spin 1 half as you have for spin 0 for spin 1 half. I mean,
yeah, but experimentally, NMR people say that they see nickel has much less magnetic impurity than zinc in this place. I don't remember why.
So I cannot really comment on that. All we have done so far is dilution with zinc and magnesium. Initially, we started with zinc. Then realized we couldn't go very far in terms of our single crystal growth. Then we put in both magnesium and zinc, because one has a smaller. So to answer your question, I don't have the answer. We haven't tried yet. But just since I started this, zinc has a smaller larger ionic radius than copper, and magnesium is slightly smaller ionic radius. So we found that when we put in both, we could actually dilute further out and grow crystals, the two much larger. Nickel, one should try. I think there might be some powder work, actually. So this is where we did our neutron work in Maryland at the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And should acknowledge the really nice warm hospitality and help by the NIST staff. Just very briefly, we worked with modified triple axis spectrometer, triple axis scattering. Neutrons get scattered three times at the monochromator to select an energy, then at the sample, and then energy analyzed to do Bragg scattering again before they reach the detector. The notation is that Q is the momentum transfer to the sample, and omega is the energy transfer to the sample. And what we are interested in is, well, let me show you first actually some structural data which were taken in triple axis mode. This is what I alluded to earlier. This is a sample that is diluted with about 33% combined zinc and magnesium. And what we found to our surprise is that the system undergoes a structural transition. So at high temperatures, the system is tetragonal, just as the undoped system. And then at intermediate temperatures, it's orthorhombic with the octahedra tilted, as I showed you earlier. And this is a transition into a low-temperature trigonal phase in which still the octahedra are rotated, but now with a rotation axis that itself is rotated by 45 degrees. So in this low-temperature phase, two out of the four oxygens neighboring the copper remain in the planes. So that's the tilt axis, and one moves down and one moves up. The unit cell doubles again, and this transition is weakly first order. So as you heat, you see additional peaks emerging, and at higher temperatures, about 120, you have two peaks which are actually of quite different intensity, which is not uncommon. One has structural domains, and the difference in intensity just simply means that these domains are populated differently. This transition into a low-temperature tetragonal phase has been seen in barium-doped lanthanum copper oxide, which is a high-temperature superconductor, which around 1/8 barium doping undergoes such a transition, and in that low-temperature tetragonal phase, actually, it's been found that the superconductivity is pretty much suppressed. And what we're doing here is by primarily putting in magnesium for copper is pretty much the same as what barium doping in lanthanum copper oxide does. That is, barium has a slightly smaller, a larger ionic radius than lanthanum, and so it changes the bond mismatch between the rare earth oxygen distance and the transition metal oxygen distance in the fashion as doping in the sheets with ions that have a slightly smaller ionic radius than the copper. So this is, in the end, it's not so surprising, but we didn't quite expect that. It has implications for the detailed spin Hamiltonian, which need to be sorted out, of course. So associated with this structural transition is a new set of Bragg reflections, the 110 and equivalent in orthorhombic units. And just to show you, this intensity drop is fairly steep. It's again, it's a weakly first order transition. Then again, data taken in triple axis mode, so essentially elastic scattering. Now at the magnetic superlattice position to map out the magnetic order parameter. The intensity observed is proportional to the order parameter squared, and for the two samples shown here, the 29 and the 33% diluted samples, you get nail temperatures about 30 and 15 Kelvin. And the lines are fit to not just the power law, but the power law with the rounding, allowing for a Gaussian spread in transition temperatures. And we find that the spread is typically 4 to 5 Kelvin, which is an indication of the rather good quality of the samples. The nail temperature itself depends rather strongly on degree of dilution, and having basically a spread of only 4 degrees in these cases means that the dilution is fairly homogeneous. This is not a priori. It's not clear from the onset that in growing these crystals, even though if they're single crystalline, that the concentration distribution is fairly homogeneous.
Question: mm-hmm. Is there also weak permanent moment in those states? In those samples, we don't have the
difference. We do see the cusp in the susceptibility data. So if yes, so I believe that there is still a remnant weak ferromagnetic moment in the LTT phase. So the static structure factor, typically one measures the dynamic structure factor, which is the neutron intensity, is proportional essentially to the dynamic structure factor. But to obtain the static structure factor and from that the magnetic correlation length, instantaneous spin spin correlation length, one needs to integrate over energy, which can be done experimentally by basically taking out the analyzer crystal and pointing the detector directly at the sample. And we were interested in mapping out the static structure factor in the paramagnetic phase above the nail temperature of these samples. And so what one has in the paramagnetic phase, instead of Bragg peaks, one has rods of 2D scattering. So the cross-section essentially does not depend on the momentum transfer perpendicular to the copper oxygen sheets. And what one does measure is the data I will show you in a moment, are essentially scans in momentum space across this rod of 2D scattering. And the inverse width of this rod is the spin-spin correlation length. So here are some data for the 19% diluted sample and also for the 29% diluted sample. These data were taken with the same instrumental configuration so that the momentum resolution throughout was the same. And the resolution is indicated here. These are scans of the type that are just indicated schematically, momentum scans. And you see that for this 19% sample at 200 Kelvin, the data are clearly broader than resolution. Basically, here this is the 29% sample at the same temperature. You see that dilution broadens the scattering, decreasing the correlation length, increasing the width. And for the 29% sample upon cooling, you see that the peaks sharpen. So the lines, and therefore the correlations grow, the lines are obtained from convoluting the intrinsic cross-section, which we assume to be a Lorentzian, a 2D Lorentzian. With the experimental resolution function and doing a fit basically to the experimental data. So not surprisingly, the correlations decrease with the increased number of dilutants and increase upon cooling. So this is the data I showed you earlier for lanthanum copper oxide together with Monte Carlo, the circles, and the quantum nonlinear sigma model theory. And this is a log-log plot of the correlation length versus inverse temperature in units of J. And throughout all of that, J was kept at 135 millielectron volt, which is the value believed to the value known for the undoped system to within, I would say, 5 or 8%, 8 or 10%. As I mentioned earlier, there, of course, the next nearest neighbor couplings and so on, which one doesn't know to within better than I would say 5% or so. I'm comparing now with the red symbols are the data for the 7% diluted sample. And you see temperature dependence is qualitatively the same. To reach the same correlation length, you need to go to a lower temperature. Oh, I will show you a different plot in a moment, but basically to be able to put all these data onto the same plot, I chose a log-log plot for the time being. Because I want to span a rather wide range in inverse temperature and a rather wide range in length. This is data for the 90% sample. And again, I'm showing you only data, of course, in the paramagnetic regime. So here the correlation length reaches about 50-60 lattice constants, and then the system orders three-dimensionally, versus the lower dope systems where the length exceeds 100 lattice constants before the 3D regime is entered. And then I have also data for the 29% sample. And looks less and less exponential, but more and more power law like. And for that reason, I want to replot it now in a different fashion. So this is the inverse correlation length as really directly extracted from these fits to the experimental data for the 90% sample versus temperature. It's a power law fit, and it gives an exponent of about 2.5. And then for the 29% diluted sample, it's a little bit tricky. Again, I mean, a power law, that's just as well. And the exponent is about 1.25. So again, only data shown above the nail temperature, which is 95 Kelvin and 30 Kelvin in this case, respectively. And then the data for the 33% diluted sample, again, above the nail temperature, and there the nail temperature, just remind you, is about 15 Kelvin. And again, this is a fit to a power law. We have less data at higher temperatures and an exponent of about 1. Now, what we then tried, of course, is to go further in dilution, and we thought that essentially, I mean, this temperature behavior is the one predicted for the quantum predictive regime of the quantum nonlinear sigma model, and that was a part of our thinking that maybe the phase diagram of the diluted lanthanum copper oxide system actually can be described by that model. And certainly there's a dramatic a change in length scales as a function of dilution. And also the nail temperature, of course, is suppressed very strongly.
May I explain the difference?
Sure.
19% will show us a hitch to the power law that looks very convincing.
Yes.
But at 19%, we are in the nail regime.
Yes.
We should see a hitch to the exponential nonlinear sigma model results. And you showed us similarly good fit to that.
So
that means that fitting to such expressions doesn't have much meaning?
Well, for the first cut, quantification of data, I think it's actually a good thing to do. Also, as I noted earlier, this renormalized classic regime this formula that I showed is really asymptotically only correct at very large length scales, and at least.
Well, I'm talking about the data. The data can equally well be fitted to two different expressions. So what does that tell us about the validity of any of those?
Oh, well, no, that's not the case.
About 19, that's more
the 90, I never tried.
That was just a guide to the eye.
Well, this is sort of a heuristic, I mean, this is a qualitative statement more than a quantitative statement. And this expression, the Hasenfeld-Niedermayer expression, I have actually not tried to fit anything to that. Because I do know it's only a low temperature result. And it's quite meaningless actually to do fits to that, unless you know, have a sense as to what the crossover possible to a possible quantum critical behavior is.
How good would a fit for the non-dilutant be to a power law? Would it be equally impressive?
No, I mean you could see from the. You could see from the data that this really does curve up.
Yeah, for a limited range, it could equally well be a straight line.
Yes, you could fit it to a power. I don't know what your chi-square would be, but
the last power, increases gradually.
Yeah. But I'm doing this in order to have some means of quantifying the data, and all I'm saying is that. As I do this, I approach a point which is around 33% dilution, where the nail temperature is very small, and where a fit to a power law gives an exponent which is at least consistent with what one expects just based on this behavior controlled by the quantum critical point. That's essentially what I wanted to say.
If you're dealing with this sort of this strong, one expects there to be a quantum critical point that's controlled by disorder, not by the pure non-critical point. Right? Particularly at usually 30%, it's very, very strong disorder, and there will be a base condition, but.
Well, it's not obvious.
Will it be a quantum critical point, or will it be a classical calculation point?
It will always be quantum. Talking about why the quantum critical is in there.
And in particular, can one? Well, let me move on, and then maybe you can discuss it afterwards. I just wanted to show you next data for a sample that had a slightly higher dilution content, 35%. The red line again is the resolution, and as you see, upon cooling from 60 to 80 Kelvin, the peaks become sharper, so the correlation still increases. But then below about 8 Kelvin, the width doesn't really change anymore. And in addition to that, I should say that in our Schmidt magnetization measurements and also from neutron diffraction, we are not able to observe any Bragg signal, any magnetic Bragg signal down to a Kelvin and a half. So this sample does not order three-dimensionally. And when I superimpose the data for this system on top of what I just showed you before, indicated by the red squares, you see that at higher temperatures, basically the data for the 35% sample fall on top of those for the 33% sample. But then at low temperatures, there's a log in to a finite correlation length. There's no nail transition in this system.
Can I ask
yes.
A question? I mean, how do you get these error bars? I mean, I just saw on this other figure, I mean, that basically this peak which is sitting on top is only one quarter or you know, a little bit more of the intensity which you actually observe.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, part of this can be sticking in this, of the peak can be, you know, down there. So how do you distinguish?
I'm not exactly sure I'm saying it correctly, but you're essentially asking...
You're
essentially asking, with this signal to background, how can the error bars precise? Yeah. Well, first of all, in the end, one has a two-parameter fit, an amplitude and a width. This is just fits to simple 2D Lorentzians. The background is in initial round of fitting is a parameter. It does change as a function of temperature. It even has a slope, as you can see here on these data. But overall, one ends up with a very good understanding of the background as a function of temperature, so that in a last round of fits, the background is not fitted anymore. There's a correlation, basically, of the background data from here to here to here to here, and then actually in this case, the background doesn't change very much as a function of temperature, at least at low temperatures. So
is that width larger enough that the instrumental with
the
scale comfortable and
yes.
Significant numbers.
Yes. Yes, it is. Basically, I mean, we have more data on this, which I'm not showing here. But basically, this is well within what we feel comfortable extracting length from. This is consistent with what I said, that is that there is no observable 3D magnetic ordering in the system. So we certainly searched quite a bit, but could not detect any nail transition. We did the same for a system with even more zinc or magnesium in it, and found, again, no nail transition, but actually a larger kappa, a smaller correlation at low temperatures. So this is a summary of our findings for the nail temperature versus dilution in comparison to what's been done by others prior to our work. So the Chong et al. Data, again, are the circles. And Kammer et al. Did some single crystal work up to 7% dilution. And our result basically starts at 7%, and we have a sample around 19, 29, 33, 35, and actually also one at 38. And basically between 33 and 35, there's a transition. So I announced that I wanted to show you some Monte Carlo data. I don't want to elaborate much on the method that we use. It is a method that was originally invented by particle lattice gauge theorists. It's a loop cluster algorithm, and it essentially involves sort of the standard Suzuki trotter mapping of a d-dimensional quantum system onto a d plus one dimensional classical system. And then on this d plus one dimensional lattice, one builds loops, selecting a random point on the lattice. There are local rules, which very few local rules, according to which loops are built. Once a loop is closed, and the loop has by default to close, one is allowed to flip the spins. The Ising-like, these are Ising-like variables in this 2D plus one dimensional problem. One is allowed to flip the spins on the loop and creates a new configuration that is a new contribution to the partition function, and then basically samples as one goes on, basically information that exists on this loop. And here are numerical data for the correlation length on the log-log plot versus, this is now temperature, okay? So decreasing temperatures this way. For a number of degrees of dilution, 7 to 20, most of them do match more or less the experimental values that I've shown you. And then also at some higher dilution where we so far have not grown any crystals, we have not tried actually. Essentially, you see that we are able, at least so far, to go up to about 20 lattice constants, which compared to the neutron data is sort of on the low end of things. But of course, with numerics, one does better at higher temperatures, lower lengths. And so we've done this partly to just check how good a model system these diluted crystals are, and also to be able to be more quantitative. For now, what I just want to show you is just a comparison of the neutron and the numerics for these systems. And now again, it's log-log, but correlations versus inverse temperature. And so this is the undiluted system. This is 7%. The open symbols are always going to be the experimental data. The black symbols are the numerics. There's no adjustable parameter because we took J to be the value from the undiluted system, 135 millielectron volts, about 1600 degrees Kelvin. And so the two, just like for the undiluted system, the two numerics in the experiment agree in the regime where they overlap. And so same for the 19% sample. Hope you can see that the numerics ends essentially here. At about 23 or so, 25%, 25 correlation length of 25 lattice constants. And we've kept the system always at a factor of 20, about a factor of 20 larger than the correlation length. So to extract a length of 20 lattice constants, we'd work on a 400 by 400 lattice. And then average over about 40 configurations. This is with periodic boundary conditions. And then and these are 3D lattices, so it would be a 400 by 400 by a few, actually 10,000.
So
How many times have you been here? Multiple times? All those shows in the
beginning? Pardon me? Yeah, this is only for the nearest neighbor Heisenberg, and which is not by default what the experimental system is. We know it is not. To first approximation, but it is, and to very good approximation, it is. As you see, I mean, there again, it's no adjustable parameter, and the numerics in the experiment agree very nicely for the 29% sample as well. And then no, you would need to know your spin Hamiltonian in detail, and here for the higher diluted samples we find also for the 38% diluted sample that the correlations lock in at a finite value, about 20 lattice constant for that sample versus 30 lattice constants for the 35% diluted sample. And again, the numerics agree with the experiment. The experimental error bars are of course much larger. So,
question. So if you sit right at the critical jumping concentration and measure psi versus t, what's the exponent you get then in your numerics?
Well, it's actually, Anna and I talked about that earlier. First of all, the numerics don't go to quite as low a temperature. Mm-hmm. So, if I were to jump numerics, I would say that the percolation, that there's a lower bound for a critical point, which is about 35% dilution, which is actually higher than that of the experimental system, where we find the nail temperature to go away between 33 and 35% dilution.
Well, I think so at that dilution, how does psi diverge as you go towards
zero? It goes approximately linear in inverse temperature. But that's something we haven't explored in detail as yet, and it's a little bit premature to read too much into the numerics, other than for the sake of the comparison that I showed you, that the experimental and numerical data are in very good agreement. But yes, to first order, it is linear in temperature.
And that exponent is actually the inverse dynamical exponent that the zero term of the quantum critical point. It tells you about length scales of temperature.
So you would expect so I would naively expect that the inverse length to go linear in temperature.
No, it goes t to the 1 over z, where z is the dynamical critical exponent. So
which is unknown for this problem.
Unknown.
Fine.
But it better be bigger than 1, probably. And
so
in other words, your number you quote.
So
from
looking at the nearest neighbor model with numerics up to lengths of about 20 lattice constants, it seems that the primary temperature dependence around 35% is inverse temperature. So T times Xi is approximately constant.
Well, the classical percolation theory would give that roughly an exponent of 1.
The neutron data for the spin 5 half system that I showed earlier have
dimensional percolation.
These are
simulations
in 2D, isn't it?
Yes.
No, he was telling about the exponent in the experiment or in the
well, well, they agreed.
You were asking about the numerics.
I was asking about the numerics.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I don't see why should we think
that numerics shouldn't have nothing to do with the dimensions,
frankly. Sorry, I missed.
In the numerics, you should indeed see two-dimensional exponents also as function of temperature.
I'm not making any statements about the exponents based on numerics at this point. So that it's an open question. But basically, if I had to say anything, then it's that the product of temperature and psi are roughly constant at around 35% dilution.
Yeah. It just seems like with spin a half and dilution at 30%, the quantum random quantum critical point should have an awfully wide critical regime, quantum critical regime, a couple of bit J, roughly. Because there's no other length scale or energy scale involved. Or an S, which is large.
What would you expect Z to be?
I don't know. Well, bigger than or equal to 1, but sure. But the dirty boson problem.
The 2 over D is where you're getting the one from?
No, it's just the, it's the lesson when you do a violent student life.
Well, one other thing is that I mean, the quantum nonlinear, well, the numerics is done on the lattice, and actually, I really don't know what that does to all of that. I mean, to rephrase it, I don't know at what length scale I should not see any lattice effects anymore. So that's not clear to me.
But you would have thought maybe just 5 or 10. Maybe it's naive because there's not a small dimensionless number.
Right. So again, to repeat what I said, I mean, based on the numerics, it's a power law dependence of kappa and roughly with an exponent of 1.
What about uniform susceptibility in the numerics? Look at that. About to have a non-jury like power law.
The uniform susceptibility is complicated because it has. It has these Curry contributions, which are very, very strong.
It should be smaller than.
I don't have any numerics with me other than for the correlation, but what we've seen in the experimental data also shows in the numerics, of course, and that's. That Curry behavior at low temperatures is very strong. So to discern anything, any effect that rides on top of that, is very hard, if not impossible, in my mind.
Is the Curry really linear in 1/T? I
mean, no, only to first order. But again, this is
first order in what? Sorry.
Well, it is approximately linear in what. But I mean, we've looked at the randomly diluted two-chain ladder with Monte Carlo before, and essentially there, there's a regime in which these ferromagnetic moments don't yet interact, and then there's a regime in which they do interact, and there's an effect on the Curry constant, basically, depending on what regime you're in. You have a temperature dependence of this constant.
Because the quantum order stay there.
In that case, you're sort of in a different universality class, that of the random bond chain.
This is totally wrong, but I mean, the naive guess would be that the quantum critical point of the pure model at zero temperature is irrelevant to this order, remains the critical point with this order. I presume that's wrong.
Not true.
How do you actually show that?
Not on the quantum case.
Because if you think about the Hamming criterion. You have to think about the time direction also. The randomness is in the d-space dimension, but there is no randomness in the time direction, which adds another power of space. So it ends up that the critical exponent for randomness is not alpha, it's alpha plus mu. So it's always relevant.
So here's my summary, basically. We've been able to grow crystals up to so far 38% dilution, which was actually highly non-trivial, and found that the system at intermediate and high dilution undergoes a structural transition into the LTT phase. We've been able to map out the spin-spin correlation length as a function of dilution and temperature for the spin 1/2 system, lanthanum copper oxide, and find that the Monte Carlo for the nearest neighbor model agree very nicely with the experiment without any adjustable parameters, and we find experimentally from both this good magnetization and the neutron results for the Nail order that the Nail order does disappear at around 34% dilution, which is well below the classical percolation threshold of 41%, and this is sort of at the minimum. I mean, this is consistent with these recent works preprints. Which find claim to have found a quantum critical point at around 33 or 30.5% dilution.
So. If C is a function of P itself instead of C or J, does you get or J as a function of C?
What do I get for the super exchange as a function of J? I don't know how. I don't have any direct results on J as a function of Z. All I can do is basically do the experiment and then compare with the numerics and say that, okay, we really don't need any change in J in order to have this agreement that I showed you. And so from that I deduce that J probably does not change very dramatically as a function of dilution. But in order to get to the value of J, one would need to actually measure spin waves, look at the Sohn boundary spin wave energy, or do other experimental work.
The correct question is not how does J vary with Z, how does rho S vary with Z, because it's rho S that appears in these exponential functionals. And rho S does decrease with Z, which causes these shifts in its data to the right. But that's
OS,
it's not J. Thanks. If you rush, there are cookies outside.
Yes,
they disappear at 3:15.
Why do you have cookies after talks, not before talks?
It's not related to the talk. Okay. The day is 3:15.
Good.
But maybe they are already gone.
As I say, enjoyed your talk.
Thanks.
We haven't met Matthew Fisher.
We've met before briefly. You gave a talk at Stanford top
year. Yeah, no, I mean, I wasn't sure you'd remember, but yeah. No.
Thanks.
Matthew, I think percolation, even in dynamics,